Welcome to the Beyond Addiction Show with Josh King. This program is designed to help those who are affected by substance use. Whether you are using, trying to stop, or a loved one who wants to help, there are many effective resources, and together we'll explore them and bring you hope. Now, here is your host, Dr. Josh King.
Hello, and welcome back to the Beyond Addiction Show. I am your host, Dr. Josh King, and today we are talking with Dr. Ken Carpenter. He is the Director of Training at the CMC Foundation for Change. We're talking with him about motivational interviewing, which is just a really cool way of interacting with people to help get them to a place where they themselves are really motivated to change. It's the leading therapeutic model for helping people change their substance use. And it's what we do here at CMC, at the Center for Motivation and Change in New York and in the Berkshires. But it's also something that really any person can learn and use in their own life. It's just a way that you are talking and engaging with others that helps bring them to their own desire to change. And Ken is going to teach us the same way that he's teaching people out in the world to use this all the time. So I'm really looking forward to that. And then today is the last episode of season three of the Beyond Addiction Show. So I just want to take a moment. We started this show about a year ago. It was November of 2018. We started this show not at all knowing what to expect. And here we are, 91 reviews later, 200,000 downloads later, and I'm just so proud of the impact that we're having. I really look forward to coming back here, hopefully around December, and continuing to bring you the most up-to-date science available about the best therapies around. So I'm really looking forward to that. I'm so happy that I have this opportunity, and I'm looking forward to continuing it. Today, I want to talk a little bit about how we talk to ourselves, the internal stories that we all carry with us. And you know the ones I'm talking about, the ones that you've had ever since you were a little kid. Maybe it's something like, I'm not that good at making friends, or I won't be successful, or I need to live a life that looks like this, like whatever that this may be for you, that you have these stories that are innate to you and that you hold, almost sometimes cherish them, even those ones that feel hard. We just hold them and we say, well, but that's who I am. And sometimes they really enhance our lives. So for example, they could be motivating. If my story is, I am going to go to a top tier college, that might help really push me to do well in school and to study at times when I just kind of don't want to. Or a story like, I'm a provider for my family, can really help push you to keep working even when you have to do really crappy jobs. I just heard a story about a woman who is working four different jobs so that she can take care of her autistic daughter. Beto O'Rourke met her, and I was thinking, like, wow, that lady, like, her stories and holding hard to that story, that must be really helpful for her to say, I'm providing for my daughter, and that is a story I hold on to tightly that just might get her through some really hard days. Unfortunately, most of our stories are not as motivating or as positive as these are. Even a story that sounds like it could be really awesome to hold on to, like I'm gonna go to a top tier college, can be really difficult and debilitating sometimes. Especially because, right, it could cause intense anxiety about any mishap that you have along the way, right? Think of the first time that you don't get an A in a class. Oh my God, what is that gonna do to my chances? What am I gonna do? How am I gonna live? It also doesn't take into account that ultimately, you have no control over the college process. You don't control admissions. So you might be that great student and you might still not get in. So what happens if I've held really tightly onto that story? I am going to go to a top tier college and I don't get into a school in my top tier. What then? What happens to you if that situation comes up? So holding on to a story too tightly can be very risky. And I think, and this shows my age, this, the movie reference that comes into my head, but I think about the old 1980 movie, I think it's 1980, Fame. Fame is this story. They redid it in the 2000s, but hopefully no one here had to go see that. In the 1980s, in 1980, they did this show, this movie about all these super talented kids who got into like Juilliard, which is this, you know, famous art school in New York City. And it's famous, it's prestigious, it's amazing that they got in. And to get in to one of those schools, you have to really say, this is what I want in my life, and hold on to that tightly. And there's a famous scene where one of the students, she's just not cutting it in her dance classes, and she's doing poorly. And she's spent so much of her life getting to that point and into that school, and now she's not doing it, and her story that she had in her head about being a dancer is crumbling. And it appears in the movie, the way they shoot it, that she held it so tightly that if it fell apart, if she wasn't going to be a dancer, she was going to have to do something drastic. And here she is. It looks like she's going to step onto a subway platform and jump in front of a subway train and kill herself. And she slowly moves towards the subway tracks, apparently ready to jump. And instead, she throws her ballet clothes in front of the subway car. And she says, well, forget it. If I can't cut it there, I'll just switch to drama. But that scene shows us both what happens when someone is holding on too tightly to their narrative and what happens when we can be flexible. Right? So in the part where she's holding on too tightly, when you run into a situation where your story is not being fulfilled, where you are not achieving what you believe you should be achieving, it can just feel terrible. That pain of saying, oh, but like this is how my life was supposed to be and it's not there, can really turn into this pain. And when I've got that pain, I want to get rid of that pain. So in this case, it seemed that she was going to get rid of that pain by jumping in front of the train, which would be, for many people, a way of saying, I'm going to get rid of the pain. When she shifts and says, oh, forget it, I'm going to the drama department, whatever, that's a sign of what we call psychological flexibility, or her own ability to shift within the circumstances of her life in order to live fully. And she was able to do that because ultimately, even though it seemed like she was holding her story very tightly, she was actually holding it pretty lightly. She was not taking it so literally that said, I must be a dancer. Either I'm a dancer or I am nothing. And so that's what we're trying to do, is we're trying to hold our stories lightly in the way that this actress did. These examples that I've been giving are examples of one type of story. They're the stories that define our outward identity. I am a psychologist. I am a teacher. I am somebody who drives this kind of a car. That's about like how the world sees me. Then there are these other stories that are about my inner world. The ones that we started out the show talking about. That I'm not good enough, or I can't be successful, those stories. And that last one, I can't be successful. So that's an important one. The stories like that, if I take that really literally, or I hold it tightly, it helps to create a very difficult circumstance with which I have to live my life. Because if I can't be successful, if I don't have that ability, if I'm not capable of it, well, how do I get promoted in my job? Or how do I do well in school? Or really anything that adds up to success, how do I engage in that? Because I'm not successful. I can't be successful. So when I get into a situation where I have to work hard and my brain says to me, oh, but what if it doesn't happen? It's not just what if it doesn't happen. It's it can't happen because you can't be successful. So then I go into a whole different set of circumstances. I tend to avoid those situations where I might have success because I'm sure I won't get it. And when that happens, my life suffers. If we apply that logic to I'll never get a good boyfriend or girlfriend or husband or wife, or I can't possibly handle that whatever that is happening to me. Well, what happens when you start dating? Do you lower your standards because you can't find a good spouse? You know you can't find one. So I say, all right, forget it. I'll just take whatever's there. Or do you maybe never start dating in the first place and say, well, love isn't going to be in the picture for me because I know I cannot find a good spouse? Or that thing that you're dreading, that if it happens, you say, oh, I can't handle if that happens to me. If it does happen, do you just fall apart? Or do you always avoid being in a situation where it could even have the possibility of happening, just in case? So that then you're cutting yourself off from the potential opportunities that the world might have for you. I say, I cannot touch any of these because it might mean that I'm going to have to face that thing that I don't want to face, that I'm dreading, that I don't believe I can handle. And so therefore, I'm out. I'm not even going to try. So clearly, holding stories about yourself can be a real pitfall in life. And yet, we actually can't help. We can't stop having them. We can't stop having these stories. They just keep coming up in our brain. So what do we do about the fact that these stories are there and they keep coming back? Well, the answer is to try and hold all of your stories about yourself lightly. And what I mean by that is don't get too stuck on any particular idea or a particular outcome. Try to hold the stories that are in your head the same way that you might hold a baby bird in your hands. And a baby bird, you got to hold it up tight enough so that it's not going to fall and hurt itself, because baby birds can't fly. But you don't want to hold it too tight that it can't move around, or that you're going to hold it so tight that it's going to hurt it. Right? You got to hold it kind of softly. And if I can recognize that my stories are just that, they're stories. They're nothing more. They're products of my brain. And then you can say to yourself, oh, that story that I can't succeed, that thing just showed up. Now, I'm not going to pay all that much attention to it. I'm not going to give it all of my attention, because that is like grabbing onto the baby bird as hard as you possibly can. Because I'm saying, I will need to hold on to this tight, 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 tight. But I'm not going to ignore it. I'm not going to pretend that it's not there, because I actually, pretending that it's not there is giving it as much attention as it would be if I was holding it tightly. I'm just going to take it with me while I go on my way, doing the things that I want to do to live my own life. Right? That's me living the life I want to live, and I'm taking the things that are in my head along with me. And that's how we build psychological flexibility. Psychological flexibility is, in many ways, the key to being able to live your life no matter what circumstances are thrown to you in the world. Because, right, a big old truck just drove past my window while I'm on the podcast, blaring sirens, and I couldn't mute. I couldn't do anything. I'm in the middle of talking, and I know that that's here in this room. I didn't control that. But being able to be flexible when sirens come through, or when noises come through, or when microphones break, or when you are suddenly overwhelmed with a feeling of, I can't do it. That's what we want to be able to do, is to say, that's there, and I'm going to take that and bring it along with me as I go and live my life. So I hope that we can all practice just taking our own stories a little bit less seriously, because, oh, well, maybe not seriously, but less literally, holding them a little bit lighter so that they don't then dictate where we go in our lives. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we get back, we're going to be talking with Dr. Ken Carpenter about motivational interviewing.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
If you are a parent or a partner who is seeking guidance in helping a loved one with substance use, be sure to pick up the 20-Minute Guide. This is a terrific resource, and proceeds help the CMC Foundation for Change. Visit the20minuteguide.com. That's 20minuteguide.com. Now there's a book for families who are looking to help loved ones. Beyond Addiction, How Science and Kindness Help People Change is now available at Amazon.com, available in hardcover, paperback, and on Kindle. Pick up your copy of Beyond Addiction today. CMC Foundation for Change is a new not-for-profit that is all about families helping families and parents helping parents through addiction from those who have been there. Over 111 million family members worldwide are affected in some way by addiction. CMC Foundation for Change helps give these families hope through support, education, and helpful resources. For more information about CMC Foundation for Change, please visit cmcffc.org on the web. That's cmcffc.org. This is the Beyond Addiction Show. If you have a question or comment about our show, be sure to send an email to beyondaddictionshow@joshkingpsyd.com. Again, that's beyondaddictionshow@joshkingpsyd.com. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. And joining me now is Dr. Ken Carpenter. He is the director of training at the CMC Foundation for Change. He's also a clinical psychologist with me here at the Center for Motivation and Change in New York City and works as an associate professor and researcher at Columbia University. Ken, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Josh. It's really nice to be here.
You're one of the few people I've let to actually come do it live here with me and have to watch me as I gesticulate all over the room while we do this. So
it's a great dimension to the whole experience.
You're in for a treat. So Ken, you've been training professionals in motivational interviewing for years. You're one of the certified MI trainers. That's MI is the acronym for motivational interviewing. And now you're training parents through the Foundation for Change. So what is it about motivational interviewing that's so powerful and impactful that it makes you want to get it out to the world?
A great question. And, you know, thinking about my experience, as you noted, coming from a clinical psychology background, we learned motivational interviewing as a way of helping people change, as a way of having conversations about change. As a psychologist, that's most often what I'm doing, is having conversations with people. So MI was really just a way to think about conversations that can be helpful, particularly for people having to make important decisions. And often it's been kind of housed up in clinical offices and housed up in books. And you know, when we think about just what it's like to be a human being and caring for someone and wanting to be of help to someone, we kind of come back to that same basic way of how we try to help people, which is often we're just having conversations with people. And the idea that motivational interviewing can be helpful in guiding these conversations, it just makes so much sense that it can be useful to any type of relationship, any type of interaction between people where someone's just trying to think about things they want to make different in their life.
I'm glad that you said it that way, because it's that idea that it can be helpful for anyone in multiple ways, that it doesn't have to be about substance use. It doesn't have to be about one particular thing, but about change in general, because it must have been over a decade ago, I actually here at CMC took a training on motivational interviewing before I worked here, and then promptly went off to help do some work in Louisiana. With schools that were adopting new curriculum, and we had to convince the teachers to adopt this new curriculum. And I kept saying to myself, oh my God, this would be an awesome application of motivational interviewing, because we're trying to ask these teachers to change the way that they've taught for years. And is that a way that we could apply motivational interviewing to get people to say, hey, can you change? Would you be open to changing the way that you're thinking about this career, the way that you're thinking about the way that you do this process?
I mean, I think one of the key ingredients and things to think about for and where motivational interviewing is coming from is it kind of put this idea of ambivalence on the map, which is you know, to your point, if someone's sitting with two minds about something and reasons for a saying going in one direction, maybe making change, and reasons for possibly not changing, there's a dilemma. There's a little bit of a tug of war going on, and it doesn't matter what behavior we're talking about, but just as being a human being, there are times when the idea of trying to choose which direction do I want to go in isn't as easy to do. So to your point, it can be a useful way of helping someone talk about that particular decision in a way that doesn't push them in a direction, but helps them really sort out for themselves what's the most important way for me to go here. In a helpful way. So sure, it can transcend all kinds of situations.
Well, and that's exactly the situation that it was. It was all these teachers were, without using that term, they were very ambivalent. They said, I want to do the best curriculum and I want to do the best teaching, but I actually don't know how to do it. And doing something different is hard. So I'm pulled to do it, but I'm also pulled not to do it and to just do what I'm used to. And that feels like it's applicable for me going to the gym. I want to go to the gym, but I don't want to go to the gym because it's uncomfortable and I don't like doing it. Or I want to change the way I'm eating and eat differently and I don't want to. And people I work with, I want to not use drugs because they're really screwing up my life, but I also don't want to feel all the feelings that I have to feel. So it sounds like it's really applicable in a lot of places.
Right, particularly in that situation, like you said, when people are torn between two worlds and they're ambivalent. And then the question becomes, how can we have conversations that help people sort that out in a way that's helpful and maybe not in a way that pushes them or makes them overly defensive, perhaps even defending the very behavior they're ambivalent about. So,
mm-hmm. So there's got to be something, you mentioned it before, of it gets sort of quarantined often, these evidence-based treatments get quarantined to therapist's office. And in some cases, that makes sense because you need a certain level of training in order to be able to do this and think about it. But MI, it's possible to bring it out to the general public. What about MI makes it easy or possible, maybe not easy, but possible to take it from the domain of professionals and bring it to just, you know, lay people who don't have this kind of training?
And I think that's really one of the cool things to think about in psychology, the idea here that, you know, a lot of the things we learn, that we research, that as professionals we're told can be helpful, really are about just being human. Not human as a psychologist, not human as a psychologist talking to someone else, but the idea of it's part of the human experience, and these kind of ideas are about that. And if we can look at it that way, it opens up a lot of doors. And what it starts to open up is two human beings talking to each other happens in all kinds of circumstances. And if that's really where it's applied to, we can start thinking about these tools being useful around the dinner table, in the office between colleagues, between father and son at the ball field, between husband and wife while driving in the car. Anytime there are two human beings talking about things, these ideas in psychology can be helpful. And there's been kind of an uptick in that. For those that are into the research world, there's been some interesting studies where parents, one in particular in Europe, where parents whose children were smoking pot but also had schizophrenia, and they were being treated for schizophrenia, but the parents were concerned about their pot use. The study was like, well, what happens if we teach parents to just learn how to do motivational interviewing at home? Would that be helpful? And, you know, those kind of studies, and in this particular study, parents that learned how to use these conversational skills showed a more significant reduction in their children's pot use than parents who didn't. So just an example of how parents can learn this and take it home and use it in their own house. And it can help the family and their kids' decision-making.
That's really awesome because so often people are told that they can't control or influence, well, you can't control, but you can't influence somebody else's substance use, that they have to be ready to do it on their own. If they're ready to change, then the change will happen. You're saying that this study said by teaching parents these skills, they were actually able to influence their kids' substance use in a positive way.
Absolutely. And they notice a change in their relationships as well. So to your point, exactly. It's kind of handing over these ideas to the lay people or the parents themselves and saying, try it out at home.
It impacted the relationships as well.
Yeah. Yep. That the parents felt better about it and their interactions with their kids improved.
That's a really nice byproduct, right? I go in hoping that you'll smoke less pot and I walk out feeling like we're closer. That's a very nice way to feel like to be reinforced for using it.
Sure thing. Icing on the cake, right?
So, and have there been other attempts at bringing motivational interviewing to parents and to like, not just in research studies, but just on a broader scale?
On some, we've seen it with peers and teaching even college students to interact with their peers in ways that can use these skills to help provide support around drinking and other tasks. And it's also been that kind of work and idea has really influenced us at the foundation in thinking about the work that we do, which is often trying to help parents learn these skills in helping their loved ones who might have a substance use disorder to think about change, and also to help parents who want to help other parents and support as well. So we're trying to extend it as well and bring it into the world in that way.
Well, let's see if we can bring it into the world in a digital way. Can you teach us a little bit? I know this isn't the whole shebang, the whole like big weekend. That's like a 3-day monster training. We've got like 20 minutes, but can you teach us a little bit of motivational interviewing that parents could say, all right, I listened to this podcast, or not just parents, anyone could say, I've listened to this podcast, I'm going to try using these skills and see if I could take them into my office or with my family and, you know, all of the different places you said.
Well, sure. And I think the first step, one thing I just want to put out there is kind of the set of lenses that we ask people when someone's sitting with someone who's got dilemmas in their life to look at. And the key issue that we brought up here is just that idea of ambivalence. It's an important concept, and it's that people can have two voices about change. Sometimes they can talk about how important it is to change, and other times they can talk about why it's doesn't make sense to change. And that doesn't mean that they don't want to change. That doesn't necessarily mean people sometimes are labeled as being in denial. That doesn't necessarily mean that things are failing for people. It's the idea of ambivalence is that's really the first step in the change process, which is, hey, I'm two minds about this. And I need to sort this out. Which voice do I want to be my guide here? And with those set of lenses, then it makes sense to think about, well, how do I talk with someone who may be ambivalent? Because how I talk to them can influence that. In other words, if I'm shouting and telling someone that they need to change, or I'm the one making the argument for why they need to change, often what we'll hear back from people is, well, this is why I can't change. So that idea of getting that signal just kind of highlights that, well, if I'm not going to use arguments or convincing, what can I use in conversation? So some of the skills that we really talk about are the things you've been using in your show right here now, which is some of the things going over are like the use of open questions. You've been asking me questions that I can't answer in a yes or no response. They're like, can you tell me more about or what? And seems easy, but often if we think about the questions we ask people, it's usually questions that they can come back with a yes or a no. But that limits our conversation.
Well, it's funny. I mean, even in that example that you gave, you just gave an open question, but you close it. You say, can you tell me more about this? And the answer, yes, I can. Or no. And so it shows, just to highlight how hard it is to actually think and keep that question open. Like, please tell me more about that, or tell me more about that versus, can you do that? And then that closes it. And it's just a small example, but it's hard even for us. I find every time I talk to people about this, I say, let's go over open-ended questions. Every question I come up with is closed. So it's really, even like people who do this all the time, it's very difficult to keep that in mind.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point to highlight. A lot of it's practice. And often as we learn to talk and have conversations, it's easy to see how we can fall into, I'll ask questions and then you say yes or no and give me short answers. The thing to highlight there is that's not really a conversation. And that can be tiring. That can be just having someone to always ask questions to just get a bunch of yes or no responses back. So first step is just helping people learn how to ask open questions. Can I learn more about what your thoughts are on that? Can I use a how? How is that sounding to you? What are your thoughts about that? Notice they are just inviting someone to talk more about what's going on for them.
Mm-hmm. And so an open-ended question, if I'm understanding this correctly, an open-ended question just gives a lot of space for the conversation to expand into other things, right? If I say to somebody, how was your day? I don't know where that's going to go, but it's going to lead me somewhere and potentially open up to, oh, okay, now I've gathered all kinds of new information that I could be asking about. Is that that's the purpose of
that's
the open-ended question?
Absolutely. A lot of space for conversations. And we get to know the person better. And an example for what we teach even for parents around the dinner table, particularly around topics that people feel uncomfortable talking about, it's like an open-ended question around substance use. If they know someone's using it, what do they get out of it? Can we understand it? So
Wait, those kind of questions. Wait a minute. There are like people's heads just exploded listening to this. And they're saying, I'm supposed to sit around the dinner table with my teenage son who is drinking and smoking pot and say, hey, what do you get out of smoking pot? Heads are like very confused. You got to explain why that is something that could potentially help lead somebody to change their substance use.
Because that's the dilemma people have. And I hear what you're saying often when those questions
are asked. So that's the ambivalence, that you're coming back to the ambivalence.
The ambivalence, that if someone's got two minds about something, reasons for changing and reasons for not, in motivational interviewing, those open-ended questions are a way of just trying to hear both sides of the argument. What is both sides of the argument this person is struggling with? Can we create, as you noted, space for us to hear that? That conversation actually can be very helpful to someone, because if they feel they don't have the space to talk about, this is what my struggle is, often people tell you what they think you want to hear, but that's not necessarily the conversation that's going to help them sort out, where do I actually want to go with this?
So lead me through where motivational interviewing would go. All right, I'm the kid who you just asked and you said, what do you get out of smoking pot? And I said, oh, it just helps me chill with my friends more. How are we getting from that to the idea of change?
By asking that question, I've created space to say, I'm trying to understand you and I know there's probably things that this is doing for you and I want to understand that. That question actually opens up more room to also find out what's not working about this. You know, notice there's a balance in that. The person is actually helping communicate what their dilemma is, but we've created space for that. If I never asked that, it just came at it about what's not working.
Right.
That may not necessarily have.
I might be sitting there saying, Dad, you don't get it. Like, screw you. You don't understand. You're not a kid. You're too old to get it. Versus when you ask that, now there's some space for me to say, well, maybe there is space for me to be understood or gotten. And you're saying that then you could ease your way into a question that it would then be about, all right, well, does it always work? Is it always you chilling with your friends?
Right, right. Opens up a lot more truthful space to talk about the pros and cons of the behavior, which mm-hmm. can be a helpful conversation for someone to have who's actually having that debate in their head anyway.
Right, because then it might lead to me saying, right, but actually, you know, I don't actually end up hanging out with them so much because I'm so anxious and in my head every time I get high that, I don't know, like I'm there with them, but I'm not really with them. And so I can maybe express both sides of the dilemma.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. So open-ended questions, asking people what they get out of substance use. That's an okay motivational technique.
Right. And just to say, keeping in the spirit of these conversational tools can be about almost any conversation. Open-end questions about how was your day today? How did you enjoy hanging with your friends? What did you think about that movie? Notice they're all open questions. They're all invitations for people to share what their thoughts are. And that's an important way of establishing communication across the board.
Okay. So open-ended questions, that's one. Mm-hmm. And I know when we do the larger training, we just sit there and ask everybody, come up with more open-ended questions. How would you close this question? How would you open this question? So we're not going to do all that today, but that's some stuff that you can do. And it's actually, isn't that in the 20-minute guide?
In the 20-minute guide and a book I'll talk about also for people to look that Bill Miller has written that's been useful, which is just how to use these skills in conversations.
Okay, so there's resources that are available to take this if you want to be practicing it. All right, what's next on the agenda here?
Well, we're talking about this thing called the AURA skills, and open-ended questions are the first step. The second is this idea of affirmations. What do helping conversations have? Well, they're the ability also to have conversations that focus on the strengths and things that are going well and that you see other people doing well, not always having conversations that on what is not working. So mm-hmm. just being able to recognize strengths people have and recognizing the things that seem to be working and highlighting that can be hugely helpful because it actually gives people the belief that it's not a biased conversation. It gives people the belief that they're also doing things and can do things that are recognized for things that are going right.
So this is that phrase, catch them being good.
Absolutely. Yes. Yes. That idea of highlighting what's going well.
Mm-hmm. So maybe if your kid says, well, yeah, pot lets me just chill with my friends. And you could say, yeah, I've noticed you have a lot of friends these days. That could be an affirmation.
Right. And just the sense that, hey, I appreciate you telling me what you're getting out of it. That's an affirmation too, which is, I appreciate our conversation.
Just saying, hey, thanks for sharing with me. That counts as saying, I noticed that you did that.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. So that one feels like it's probably a little bit easier for people to grab onto. I think a lot of people might be saying, oh, but I do that all the time. Do you find that people think they do it more than they actually do it?
I think so. Often, and it's when I put on my researcher cap in the past, it's interesting. We used to listen to a lot of conversations that people are having, either be it in treatment or outside. And often we think our conversations have a lot. But when you actually listen to what's being talked about and how people are talking, a lot of times we're not always great at actually doing what we think we're doing. And affirmations is one that's often missing. And particularly I'll highlight it in tough conversations or in times where people feel things need to be fixed. And when our minds are telling us things need to be fixed, this person needs to change, we're more likely to be focusing on what's not going right. And that means we're less likely to affirm things that might actually still be going well. And that's something, you know, again, we try to help people learn. And they compliments go a long way when they're specific and you're kind of letting someone notice, hey, something I noticed that I liked, mm-hmm. that was useful. And just highlighting that for people. It's often not the focus of our conversations, missing a mm-hmm. lot of our conversations.
I feel like I'm going to get home and my wife is going to say, hey, Ken just told me that research shows that you don't do this as much as you keep saying that you do. And I'm going to have to say to her, that's probably true. So I'm pre-apologizing to you and I will try harder. All right. So open-ended questions, then affirmations, catching them being good and like really making a mental note to just say, hey, thanks for that. I appreciate it. Or I've noticed this thing that's going well. What's next?
The other skill we kind of talk about is reflective listening. But hey, reflections are just what you've been doing with me a lot during this show, which is kind of just stating back what you hear someone and checking in with them saying or restating what they said or saying, hey, this is what I think I hear you saying. Those kind of statements can be really powerful. They're not easy to do, but in practice, they can be done in almost any conversation. And again, it helps a person just hear what they're saying and also lets the person know you're listening. Hugely helpful.
So sometimes when I'm going over this with people and I say, like, the most simple reflection is just actually repeating back what somebody says. They say, well, I'm just going to like repeat, like the person says, I feel sad. And you say, you feel sad. That's weird. Yeah. Is that what it is? Or is it like, first of all, is that accurate? Am I saying it the right way? Sometimes you could just repeat back what the person says. And then second, is it actually as weird as people think it is? I think a lot of people say like, it just feels weird if I'm just repeating what the person says.
It can be just repeating what the person says. It can be just stating back what you think you're hearing them in your own words. It doesn't have to be their words exactly. And it is interesting. It probably does feel weird initially when you first start out that way in conversations. Because we, you know, it's interesting. Growing up, we had never really taught how to have conversations. and talking is what we mostly do most of our lives. So it is fascinating, but we never learn how to do reflective listening or stating back to people what we hear. So it's that idea of practice as well. These are things that can learn and be practiced. And I think over time it becomes easier. Mm-hmm. And it actually fascinating when you see people put that into practice. It promotes conversations. If people rewind your tape, I'll date myself on that. But if they listen to the show, they'll hear a lot of great reflections that you're doing to keep me talking and state back what I'm saying. That is, the show so far has been a lot of reflective listening and open questions.
Well, thank you very much, Ken. I mean, I didn't ask for those compliments, but I will take them. It is really a pretty cool skill. And I will say, I encourage my groups to do it, to practice that. And the more that they do that, the more other people feel comfortable talking and the more conversation happens. And I think that at first they all felt a little bit weird in the group. And now they do it and it feels like second nature. They just are reflecting. And people really just start opening up and talking so much more. So I really do see what you're saying about it pushes the conversation forward.
Absolutely. And one thing, and as we've been talking about, these skills can be used in almost any conversation. I can ask my mailman an open-ended question and practice that. I can hear the person at the counter, the grocery counter, and I can give a reflective statement back. Often in our work and what we're doing with the foundation and trying to hand over these skills to parents and family members is the first thing that goes, first casualty of stress and the first casualty of particularly families who have loved ones struggling with the substance use disorder is communication. And we'll work with and talk with people who haven't had an argument-free conversation in months. Or there's absolutely no conversations whatsoever. So the communication and conversations that take a hit is how can I get back on track to start having conversations that can be helpful, to bring us closer, to get us closer on the same page so we can have the kind of helping relationship that we really want. So these skills and practicing them on a range of topics, going back to how was your day, just an open question on that can start to change the tone of these conversations so that the conversations we have with people actually are more helpful to them.
Right.
And that's where we're coming back to.
Yeah. If everything was feeling really negative, just asking how your day might feel like the nicest thing that you've said to me in months. Let's move on to the last one, S summaries. What are those?
Well, summaries are just kind of grouping reflections or just restating back, hey, we've been talking for a while and this is what I hear you saying. And maybe you can provide a summary statement to your listeners about the conversation. And you've actually provided two or three of them so far, which is just kind of coming back to the person saying, you've been talking about how difficult it is to get to the gym and you really want to lose some weight, but at the same time, your schedule is really, really hard. That's a tough position to be in. That is a summary statement. That's mm-hmm. just telling the person, this is what I hear you saying.
Right. Would it also be what I was doing earlier saying, hey, I heard this. I heard you say it this. Is that correct? Is that a summary statement as well?
That would be in line with the summary statement. It's stating back what you heard the person saying. You're just asking for clarification. So I'm going to use the term loosely here, but anytime you're giving back to the person what you think you've heard them say, and if you're checking in, that could be close to a summary statement, and you're asking them a question afterwards. That's a nice little package.
All right. So Ken, you're saying that people can take these skills that we just did, these OARS skills, and put them out and use them around the dinner table tonight?
People could ask an open question tonight. People can ask a question, open-ended question right after this show. You can practice it right away. And one thing I do also want to say, all this requires listening. And here's what's another skill I think that we just never learn about as humans, which is to sit and listen can be hard.
Oh, yeah.
So in order to ask an open question, I got to leave space for you to reply, which means I need to kind of listen. And that is another skill to practice. So even after the show, people can practice listening. And I sit and listen to what a person's saying for 2 minutes without interrupting.
All right. So it's if I can't get the open-ended questions, I can start listening and just really paying attention to that. Ken, this has been really helpful. I so appreciate this. Where can people find out more about motivational interviewing, and where can people find out more about you and the work that you're doing?
I'm just going to highlight two things. One, there's a fantastic book written for anyone who wants to practice this and learn it. And it comes right out of MI, but it's written for anybody. And it's just called Listening Well, The Art of Empathetic Understanding. It's written by Bill Miller, who is the founder of MI,
right?
And this is just a book on how to practice these skills in everyday life. So for those who feel like this could be useful to them, that's one way. Certainly the foundation work that we do on our website, cmcffc.org. We have a lot of resources that point people into how to practice these listening skills and conversational skills. Ultimately, as human beings, when we want to help someone, more often than not, we're going to start doing that by listening and having conversations with them. So those resources are on that website in the 20-minute guide and other resources that we list there, as well as the trainings that we're doing.
And yeah, those trainings, are they local or where are they? When are they?
We have one coming up into Canada and Toronto. I'll be up there this weekend working with parent coaches, which are parents who are there to help other parents whose loved ones are struggling with substance use disorders. And that's really just a parent-to-parent helping network. And it's really, they do great work there. And the other is in Connecticut with the Connecticut Women's Consortium on November 2nd and 3rd. It's weekend. It's open to any parents and families that want to learn these skills. And that can also, that information can be found on our website as well.
All right, great. So please check out the website if you want to know more about this, cmcffc.org. And Ken, thank you so much for joining me on the show. This has been great.
Josh, thanks for having me. It's been a blast.
Yeah. So, all right, we're going to take a little break. We'll be back after this.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
Now there's a book for families who are looking to help loved ones. Beyond Addiction, How Science and Kindness Help People Change is now available at Amazon.com, available in hardcover, paperback, and on Kindle. Pick up your copy of Beyond Addiction today. If you are a parent or a partner who is seeking guidance in helping a loved one with substance use, be sure to pick up the 20-Minute Guide. This is a terrific resource, and proceeds help the CMC Foundation for Change. Visit the 20MinuteGuide.com. That's 20MinuteGuide.com. CMC Foundation for Change is a new not-for-profit that is all about families helping families and parents helping parents through addiction from those who have been there. Over 111 million family members worldwide are affected in some way by addiction. CMC Foundation for Change helps give these families hope through support, education, and helpful resources. For more information about CMC Foundation for Change, please visit cmcffc.org on the web. That's cmcffc.org.
Have you become a member yet? Sign up now to become a member of Voice America. It's always free and easy. Plus, you get to take advantage of some great member benefits. Get unlimited access to millions of hours of on-demand content across all of our channels. Keep track of your favorite episodes, shows, and hosts in your own customizable library. Find out what shows you might be interested in based on your favorites. Plus, you get insider access with our newsletter. Membership gives you more. Sign up at voiceamerica.com and click register at the top right.
This is the Beyond Addiction Show. If you have a question or comment about our show, be sure to send an email to beyondaddictionshow@joshkingpsyd.com. Again, that's beyondaddictionshow@joshkingpsyd.com. Now, back to the show.
And I'm so glad that we could end this season with... I'm so glad that we could end this season with Ken coming in here and talking with us like that, because it just feels like that's the practical applications that we want to be able to have, that we want to make sure that everybody understands that you can take this stuff and you could do it at home. This is not, some of it is not, don't do it at home. But for a lot of this, there's little things that you can be doing. And I have asked almost every single guest that has come on this show, what can people do today? If you can't get to this kind of therapy, if you don't have the interest yet, if you're just not there, if you're not capable of doing it yet, what could you do today? And every one of them said, oh, well, here's a couple things. And those couple things, it sounds like, oh, well, here's just a little thing. It has a major impact. And one of the things that Ken and I have been talking about, because we both trained people, parents in this through the Foundation for Change, is that when we sit there and we're doing the training and we say, all right, here's some skills, and everybody goes back and we say, well, is it really worth it? Is it really helpful? Is it helping them? It almost never fails. We get emails or we do research follow-ups and people come back and say, you have no idea how much asking open-ended questions and practicing reflections has impacted my family. We can talk to one another again. We are able to talk to one another again and build relationships again. And that has changed everything. Like, whoa, that's amazing. That is truly, truly amazing. Here is a little thing. In the grand scheme of things, that's a small step. But to be able to take that and say, I'm going to take that home with me and I'm going to go and do it. And that has the potential of changing my world. That, what more could you ask for? And so I'm so glad that we could end this season, this set of shows on that note, to be able to say, hey, here are just really practical skills that you can take and that you can do at the dinner table. You could do it at work. You could do it at the, you know, at the, around the water cooler. If I mean, we have a water cooler here. I don't know if every office still has them, but that you can go and do, and that could impact the way that you engage with other people and how the world engages with you, and can actually have a major benefit to your life. Like, that feels so awesome to me. So I'm so glad and so proud that I get to be a part of getting this out there. And, you know, over the next month or so, while I'm taking a little break, gathering up our next group of guests, who I'm telling you, it's going to be pretty awesome, because as this show gains momentum, more and more people keep coming to me and saying, I want to be on this show. Now, I've got amazing things to say about this, and I'm doing this kind of treatment that I'm like, oh my God, that's so cool. So we're going to have really, really cool guests coming up. But the idea that we can send you off here with these skills and that you can go back and listen to them. We talked about motivational interviewing in our second episode, and we've talked about this in other places. But don't let my break be your break. Use this time to practice. So until the next time that we all talk, I'm Dr. Josh King. I so appreciate doing this with you, and I appreciate you listening to the end, and I will talk to you shortly.
Thank you for joining us this week for the Beyond Addiction Show. Join us again next Thursday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. Until the next program, we wish you encouragement and hope.